Thanks, Stan and Juhai and Amy for putting this together and for having me here. The idea of this talk is that I'll tell you about this emerging field over the last 15 years or so, called stochastic thermodynamics. And as yesterday, there were many requests, you know, what can it do for you? So I think it can do something for biomolecular processes. Cellular is certainly harder, but at some point, I guess, we hope to get there too. Okay, so then also asked me to give a kind of introduction to the non-experts. So I'll start by talking about the difference between classical and stochastic thermodynamics. And then I'll introduce this idea of having thermodynamics not only in the on an ensemble level, but along individual trajectories, first in equilibrium and then later in open systems, non-equilibrium steady states. And here we'll look at the non-equilibrium energetics of DF1 TPAs, which is a kind of, you know, Ising model for the field. And then the second part, I'll introduce this new concept Rob is obviously excited about, the thermodynamic uncertainty relation. And at the very end, and this is moving in a sense a little bit towards this idea of cellular processes, our results on the cost of coherent oscillations, of having oscillations and keeping their phase stable. We'll see that there's a minimal cost to that as well. Okay, so I guess all of you know, 200 years ago, people wanted to understand the laws. Oh, sorry for that. The laws which govern these kind of machines and what are constraints when you want to transform a certain energy, form of energy into another one, heat into mechanical work, and so on. And more recently, experimentalists were able to look at much smaller rotary motors. This is the F1 ATPAs, nanometer scale machine. And well, the question is whether or not the laws which have been developed here can be applied to systems like this. And as a physicist, you should appreciate that this is a non-trivial question, because you have to look at the scale. So this is from a nice introductory view some time ago from Bustamante and co-workers. So classical thermodynamics is up here. So on the y-axis is this power dissipation rate. And here on the x-axis is size. So you see steam engines, car engines are up here. And if you go to single molecule, you have to go down 20 orders of magnitude in power, and 10 orders of magnitude in size. And it's non-trivial to show that the laws which were developed up here can be applied down here or with appropriate modifications. So that's a kind of conceptual problem. Okay, little bit of historical perspective. As I said, 200 years ago, classical thermodynamics, if you want. Yes, please.
So the last slide.
Yes.
Does it matter at all that on that side, the molecules happen to have some biological relevance?
That's a good question, but I think on this stage, just looking at scales, not yet. Okay. Right? I mean, if you had an artificial small compound, you'd probably put it here as well. Perhaps a little bit higher, it may not be as efficient. Mm-hmm. We'll come to that, yes?
Why did you choose these two particular quantities?
Well, that was Bustamante's choice. You know, I guess he hoped, and I think it's kind of striking, right? I mean, power, if you know, you talk about machines, right? How do you characterize a machine? The best quantity to characterize a machine is actually efficiency. Why is it the best? Because it's dimensionless. The second best is power, because that's what you want the machine to deliver. Okay, and size, of course, is just something we're used to, right? I mean, we are here, and this is 8 orders of magnitude smaller. So kind of striking. Yeah, by the way, I'm very happy for interruption. So this is not meant a one-sided show here. OK, yeah, I was saying that if you have to find two equations for classical thermodynamics, it's presumably the first law and the second law, entropy can only increase. This is a phenomenological theory, and people, you know, have been quite ingenious to come up with these laws after decades of work. And the equilibrium part of thermodynamics got its more thorough underpinning around turn of the century, Maxwell, Boltzmann, Gibbs. And again, if you want to find one equation, it's presumably this one. The probability for a system in equilibrium to be in state I is e to the minus energy EI over KBT. This is about equilibrium. About this time frame, people started looking quantitatively at non-equilibrium processes, and one systematic theory is linear response around equilibrium, and that comes by the name of Onsager, Quinn-Kubo, fluctuation-dissipation relation. And that was, you know, more or less state of the art, when in the 90s, people discovered exact relations which were supposed to be true way beyond linear response of some equilibrium system, deep in the non-linear regime. And that the first one was what is called the fluctuation theorem. I will tell you about it later. Second pillar in the sense of this field of stochastic thermodynamics is the Yajinsky relation and ramifications of it. And you know, I was shameless enough to put the latest achievement here on this list. Yes, please.
The 1866, the Boltzmann equation, right? I mean, that's non-equilibrium.
That's non-equilibrium, yes, for rare gases.
Right.
Dilute systems.
Right.
Yes. So right. I'm putting, yes. I mean, this list is not meant to be exhaustive.
Okay.
You're certainly correct, yes. You know, coming from biophysics, aqueous solutions are important, so the systems are always kind of dense.
Right.
What we are interested in. That is perhaps an excuse of missing Boltzmann's. One of the many Boltzmann's achievements. Okay, so the one slide on classical thermodynamics, just as a reminder, who is not physicist here? Okay, good. So this is physics 101 for non-physicists. So here you have a piston. You want to press that piston from an initial value lambda naught to a final value. You want to compress the fluid in here, fluid or gas. And you do that while the system is in contact with the heat bulb, with the surroundings. And this will cost you some work, force times distance, essentially. And then classical thermodynamics tells you two laws. First of all, the work you put in either increases the internal energy of the system or is dissipated as heat in the environment. And the energy change of the environment, the dissipated heat, leads to an entropy change of the reservoir of the environment. Second law tells you that the total entropy change of the universe cannot decrease in any process. So here the total entropy change is that of the system plus that of the reservoir. So this has to be larger than zero. You combine those two, you find that the work you put in is bounded from below by the free energy difference, which corresponds to the two equilibrium states associated with these two positions of the control parameter. So the work always has to be larger than this delta F or delta G for the chemists. So the dissipated work has to be positive. This is classical thermodynamics. Okay, now suppose we want to do the same thing. Pushing a molecule is possible, but kind of hard. So let's rather pull it, i.e. unfold it. So this is my theorist's version of, let's say, a protein. You'll see more truthful sketches later. So we want to unfold that, applying work. Or this is an example for mechanical driving. There's also biochemical driving. Here in the F1 ATPase, that synthesizes typically ATP and is driven by proton gradients across the membrane. So the basic fundamental question is, for these kind of processes, how to define the first law, how to define work. You will expect that even if you do that in the same way 100 times, the work may fluctuate because it's a very small system and it's embedded in this heat path. So we'll get distributions for work even if we fix what is called a schedule or the protocol, how we go from here to there in time. We'll have to deal with distributions. If we get a distribution for work, we'll get a distribution for heat. Just told you that heat leads to an entropy increase in the surroundings. So now it looks like we would get a distribution for an entropy increase as well, which at first sight may sound a little bit strange because we're used to think of entropy as an ensemble property. So these are the kind of conceptual questions which need to be answered if that program is going to be successful. So let me show you one example. Again, it's a kind of, you know, neoclassical experiment by Bustamante's group, 2002, the first experiment about what is called the Yajinsky relation, which will be on the next slide, but let me first introduce. It's basically this kind of experiment. So you do it with an RNA hairpin, which can fold on itself. So this is the structure. You put this hairpin, you put two molecules, linker molecules, at the end of the two strands it's one strand, but at the two ends, you put these linker molecules. You attach these linker molecules to huge micron-sized beads, and these beads can be manipulated by optical tweezers. So you can move these beads apart, and then this hairpin structure unfolds. And if you let it go back, it will refold. If you do that very slowly, you get the blue curves. This is the force extension curves. The scales are important. So this is force, it's piconewtons. Extensions are nanometers. If you do it 50 times, you get this kind of overlaid curves, depending on the velocity with which you pull. So the blue is, as I said, the slowest. If you pull fast, these are the red ones, you see a hysteresis. So it unfolds at another force, then it refolds. So this kind of cycle here, this the area of this force in this force extension diagram, that will be dissipation. That is lost. Because if you do things very slowly, you do it quasi-statically, there is no dissipation. If you do it faster, there is hysteresis, dissipation. And if you do it 50 times, always with the same velocity, you see that the trajectory still look different. You know, there are fluctuations. This is what I just talked about. You can do the statistics. So for instance, when you pull for 25 nanometers and you measure, you know the force, you know the extension, so you know the work you put in. If you subtract the free energy difference with respect to these two positions, you get this kind of distribution. So the blue distribution is the work distribution, if you do it slowly. The green one, you do it faster. The red one, you do it even faster. What is important? Important is the zero here. You see, for each velocity, there are events where the dissipated work is negative, i.e., where the work you need to unfold the molecule is less than the free energy. And this is something classical thermodynamics would not allow you. Classical thermodynamics, we had this inequality, was that the dissipated work always is positive. But of course, classical thermodynamics doesn't talk about distributions. Yes, please.
So did you know that the structure of the RNA is always in the exact same structure? So could some of these trajectories where you have a negative work be because the RNA is actually misfolded and it's not in that lowest energy structure?
Well, you see, there is no concept of misfolded or correctly folded in a sense here. We're just looking at the statistics of the work. And you're perfectly right. I mean, if you follow the precise conformation over one trajectory and compare it to the other, there will be differences. Perhaps this thing will first open, and in the other trajectory, this one will first open. All these kind of effects are included.
But you might actually be starting with some of your RNA molecules in the secondary structure?
No, I don't think that this is the reason, actually. It's a dynamical effect in the process of unfolding. I think, the initial distribution is supposed to be thermalized. So the lowest free energy state will be the most populated, but there may be metastable minima which are populated according to their Boltzmann weight. That's the idea. Yes, please?
Should I think of these negative energy dissipation events as thermal fluctuations that just happen to drive the system back to its equilibrium position without applied work?
Yes, precisely. Yajinsky in 97 found and proved a remarkable relation about the statistics of these non-equilibrium work values. He showed that if you put the work in the exponent and you do a non-equilibrium average, i.e. you do an average over these 50 traces, even though the W is non-equilibrium, At the end of the day, this kind of average will become e to the minus delta f kvt. Yes?
Do I have to worry about whether or not the free energy is well-defined in the sense that if you sort of pull it at different speeds and depending on how the experiment is set up, you might imagine that certain microstates are essentially never accessed due to non-ergodicity or something?
Okay, so free energy, good point. Free energy is defined only in equilibrium. I.e. free energy is defined for a fixed position of these two beads. And then if you wait infinitely long, as you'll see on the next slide, all relevant states should be populated. I'm not, Olin Gazinski is not talking about a free energy, a dynamical free energy or a non-equilibrium free energy. That's a, you know, rather delicate and often misrepresented concept. So the theorem here, this is the delta F between, you know, certain extension and 30 nanometers more. That's important. This is, so the delta F is defined for any, let's say, delta extension, and more precisely, delta in the position of the two beads.
So can I think then of some of the fluctuations in the work done as essentially being arising from non-ergodicity as a result of pulling it in a finite time? Is that another way of looking at the same?
Yes. I mean, along a dynamical control parameter, you will typically not exhaust all the, I mean, the energy shell, of course, is dangerous too because it's coupled to a heat path. But yes, it's definitely a non-equilibrium effect. And what you can show is if you pull infinitely slowly, this blue distribution should become delta-like at zero. So even on the trajectory level, if you pull infinitely slowly, the work is always precisely the free energy difference.
Is there a time scale that says what's fast pulling and what's slow pulling?
Yes. I mean, the molecule has a kind of relaxation time. And if you pull faster than that, loosely speaking, you will have deviations from a delta peak here. Okay. So I'm not going to prove it. It's not very hard, but I think there's no point in showing it. It's about 5 lines if you do it correctly. And it was a big surprise, because when you see it for the first time, you should actually not believe it. I didn't believe it when I saw it for the first time almost 20 years ago, because this is non-equilibrium. This depends on how you go from, you know, whether you do the blue ones or the red ones. But if you take these distributions, put it in the exponents of these values, average it, then you get this, which is completely independent of the speed. Yes?
I recall that use of this relationship comes from idea that instead of doing one slow experiment, you can do many fast experiments and gain in the speed of getting information. Is this true?
Not really. If you talk to the computational experts, the problem is, you know, this is highly nonlinear. And it's dominated by rare events.
Right.
And you have to make sure that you sample often enough to catch these rare events.
So this not
so at the end of the day, I think from a numerical perspective, it doesn't really help.
So it has no practical importance?
Well, I think that's a strong statement. I mean, but its conceptual importance is presumably larger than its practical importance. Okay?
Well, I mean, for these pulling experiments, my understanding is they couldn't pull slow enough to do it adiabatically, right? So if you just tried to do this, they can't go slow enough. So you have to look at the distributions. There'd be no way to estimate free energies without something like this.
I mean, if you assume you have a Gaussian distribution, that you have a Gaussian distribution, and you can prove that in that limit you should get a Gaussian distribution, then you know, it's sufficient to measure the mean and the variance, and then you can, for instance, get the delta F. Yeah. That's a kind of middle ground between this infinitely slowly point of view and the finite time pulling. Okay, so now I want to talk a little bit more about what I like to call mesostates, or what people could call mesostates, and this will lead me then also more to the thermodynamics and to the heat. And I use as an illustration a really beautiful experiment from Matthias Rieff's group in Munich. So there is this small peptide, modulin, which essentially, you know, forms two globules, and you do the same experiment as before, but now we keep the distance fixed. We keep the molecule under a fixed force, and this is, for all practical purposes, like equilibrium. It's just like having the molecule, and you put a weight on one end. These are the different forces. So, this is the time trace of one experiment, and the different colors are different mesostates. They were able to observe six different mesostates. So here, under low force, both spheres are folded. Here, the blue one unfolds. Blue one is totally unfolded. Red one totally unfolded, misfolded, and whole molecule unfolded. This is the color code. And now, because all these come with different lengths, you can distinguish these conformations by their length. And here you see, for instance, at this high force, 11 piconewton, you have mostly the red one, a little bit of green, a little bit of blue. So it's mostly unfolded, but you have a little bit of this one and a little bit of that one. No, this one rather, I think. Okay. Let's look at this. So here is the probability in equilibrium from a very, very long trajectory to observe at a fixed force a certain state. And you see there are forces in this area or in this range where you can observe all six mesostates along a time trajectory. You can also measure the lifetime of a state or the decay probability of a state, and what they find, to very good approximation, these are exponentially distributed. Okay, so this is experiment. We have this kind of data. What can we do with this data? Next couple of slides are with a few equations. So biologists, you just listen to my words and look at the words and not too much at the equations. So on this part, I remind you, you have any system. As long as you're on the level of microstates, you have an energy. The whole thing is in contact with a heat bath. You define free energy, internal energy, and entropy according to the usual rules. Now, suppose you have such a molecule, and I've tried to sketch here two different mesostates. You can do the same. You can identify a free energy, internal energy, and entropy on the level of mesostates by just counting those microstates which correspond to a certain mesostate. So this is a well-defined procedure. So it's many, many to one mapping, and you just get the corresponding equations. Now the key point is that you don't have to do this calculation. Typically, you will not know the energy precisely on the level of microstates. You can extract it from the experiments. How do you do it? Well, you know that in equilibrium, the probability, let's say, of being in state I or being in state J is given by the ratio of the times you spend, right? I mean, here, the probability, the red one, is much larger than the green one, which means that the free energy of the red one is much lower than that of the free one. So you can extract, that's an important point, you can extract the free energy of these mesostates from experimental data. Now, they didn't do it the next natural step. Now you imagine you do the same thing at a slightly different temperature. You could look at this derivative from data, and you would get the energy and the entropy. I think that's something they should do. Yes?
For this, was it important that the mesostates in the experiment had exponential dwell times?
No, not yet. Very good question. This you can do for any dwell time statistics. We're not using Markovian dynamics here yet. We do use Markovian dynamics on the next slide. But this you could do without.
So a quick question.
Yes?
So the theory that this assumes that you have these mesostates.
Yeah.
Theory setup, so it's only possible to make a transition from one adjacent state to another.
No. Actually, in the paper, you'll find the energy landscape. It's not just a sequence. You can more complicated topology. No assumption. No, you know, no further assumptions. And what you call a meta state at this level is up to you. You just have to distinguish experimentally. There will be more constraints when we go for this slide here. So now we want to do a dynamics. So we have this trajectory, right? It's in the red state, in the green, in the red. If there is a timescale separation in the following sense, suppose that transitions within one mesostate are fast, the side chains wiggle fast, and transitions between the mesostates are slow. If this is true, and it's an if and only if, you can write down a first order in time master equation for the probability to be in a mesostate I. You gain probability if the system jumps from J to I, and you lose with this term. So here we have rates. Now there's an important thermodynamic constraint. You cannot choose these rates as you want. I mean, you can try to extract them from experiment, and this is what they did in the paper. But you know from theory that individual rates are free, but the ratio between a forward and a backward rate has to be the same as the equilibrium probabilities, which you measure, i.e. has to be the same as exponential of the free energy difference, or if you prefer the other potentials like this. This is an important constraint. It's called local detailed balance. And you find quite a number of papers in the older literature where this kind of thing is not respected. So in my opinion, you should always respect that. Okay.
What if the system is driven?
Oh, we're still in equilibrium, Rob.
No, I know.
Ten more minutes.
It's just when you said always, I just wanted to make sure you didn't mean like always.
Always in equilibrium, and as you will see, in a certain sense, even always under non-equilibrium conditions. Hold your breath for two more slides.
What does it look like when the transitions aren't slow?
Then this doesn't work. And then you get what is called non-Markovian effects. You see, one consequence of this relation is that you have a constant probability to jump from I to J if you're an I now. And it doesn't matter when you entered I, and it doesn't matter from which other state you entered I. There is no memory. You can predict the future solely on the knowledge of the present. It doesn't help you to know about the past. You know, very different from human behavior. Yes?
So, Muru, just for me to understand, so as fast as the transition is, as larger the free energy difference is between the two states?
No, not necessarily. You see, the free energy difference is here, and, you know, both could be fast or slow.
Yeah.
It's about the ratio.
Okay.
You cannot make absolute statements on the rate. You see, you take your rates and you scale them by a million, and it's still thermodynamically consistent.
Because this is about barrier.
This is?
A ratio is there is a barrier.
There is a barrier, right? There is a barrier between the two states, yes. And that barrier could be high or low, and it wouldn't change the adjacent states. Yes, that's true.
One more question. Is there a way to internally define what slow means?
Well, I mean, you would have a relaxation time within each state, and that time should be much faster than the inverse rates, roughly speaking. But now you would have to have a more specific model or more specific data. This much you can say on very general grounds. Okay, one more slide and then we're done with this. So we introduced the mesostates, their potential, their thermodynamic potentials. We talked about dynamics. Now let's look at the thermodynamics along such a trajectory. So suppose the molecule jumps from red to green. What is the heat dissipated in this transition? Does that make sense? Okay, so Sekimoto, I think, was the first to point out that on this level there is the first law on a trajectory level. So obviously, the internal energy becomes a stochastic quantity, right? Here we have the internal energy of the red one. Here we have it of a green one, red one. So suppose the green one is higher. Where does this energy come from? It comes from the thermal bath. So it hits what we call heat. It's energy which is lost by the bath, and that's heat transferred from the bath to the molecule. Right? So this is this relation. I mean, in a sense, it's an identity about energy conservation. And we just call heat the energy change of the bath. There is also an entropy to the system. I already introduced the idea that each mesostate has an entropy. Turns out, I don't want to do this here in too much detail, there is an additional factor which knows about the whole distribution. And when you add this change of system entropy to the heat, which is the reservoir entropy, you get the total entropy change when you jump from I to J. And when you work it out, you find it's a logarithmic ratio of these quantities. So this is essentially the flux from I to J, and this is the flux from J to I. Now, with these identifications or definitions, you can prove a kind of Yerzynsky-like relation. Actually, it's a little bit more general. So if you look at the total entropy change along a trajectory, you average over many trajectories. This exponential average is always 1, which will tells you by Jensen's inequality that on average, in the mean, the entropy change is always positive. And it holds for any initial distribution. Now you don't have to assume that you start in a thermally equilibrated distribution. And of course, this looks like the second law on the ensemble level, which was actually found much earlier by Schnackenberg. Is this a proof of the second law? Who thinks this is a proof of the second law? I mean, this is a theorem, as is. But it's not a proof of the second law because we have put in irreversibility by hand when we wrote down the master equation. It should not be mistaken as a fundamental proof of the second law. Okay, now we come to Rob. Because, yeah?
So you said the heat from the bath goes in. Unraveling. So is it like a heat engine then?
Not yet.
The temperature then of the bath drops or?
No. Temperature of the bath is always
still kept.
It's always the same. Temperature of the bath doesn't fluctuate, doesn't drop. This is aqueous solution. By definition, a bath has a well-defined temperature, which does not change if you put energy in or out. That's the very essence of a heat bath. I know that some people like to deviate from this, but I don't.
So all three of these are in the same thermodynamic?
They are all at the same temperature. They're all in the same bath. In this kind of theory, if you do it properly, temperature does not fluctuate. And you always have to assume that the bath is much bigger than your molecule, which of course is true in practice. Okay, so Rob wants to go to German.
Can I just ask one question before we get to the really hard stuff? So this is all predicting the probability of a lot of these different mesostates, right?
Yes.
For an individual particle.
Yes. Yes.
Suppose you have a population of particles, which you normally do. Are they all
okay,
independent in a situation like this?
Well, it depends. I mean, you see, I don't agree with your statement, which you normally do, because here you have one molecule. That's the whole point. You can do these single molecule experiments. Of course, if you do bulk experiments, you have many. And this is probably what you're referring to. And then, you know, if they don't talk to each other, each single one will follow these rules. But then, of course, if you look for the time evolution of the mean energy in your whole ensemble, of course, you get something like, you know, large numbers and Gaussian distributions and so on. I mean, the new aspect of this is that we can actually do thermodynamics on the single molecule level. And of course, if they interact, it gets more complicated. Okay, so.
Question,
maybe
I just lost a little bit. So you said
you
put the irreversibility there. So where was that
explicitly? Here. This is first order in time. This is irreversible. Think about Newton's equation.
Right.
You have double dot here.
So, means that's not zero, it is?
Well, the very fact that it's first order in time necessarily means that you decay towards equilibrium, but you never go from equilibrium to a non-equilibrium state. This is not a reversible dynamics. It's an irreversible dynamics because it's first order in time. You can basically only go downhill. There's no inertia. Okay. So now we want to do a molecular motor, a driven system. How is a molecular motor driven? It's driven by an abundance of ATP. And here is my sketch. So here is a, let's say, kinesine, a double-headed molecule. This is a microtubule. The red stuff is ATP. ATP binds, gets hydrolyzed. ADP and PI go away, and then the next red one will come, and it will move one step. And while doing so, it's pulling a weight. So in a sense, this is still very similar then as what we did before. If we include the chemicals and if we include the weight into the description. So the whole system is now the core system, which is the enzyme or molecular motor, plus the surrounding solution, plus the weight. But we can still look at the free energy difference, which now has three contributions. This is the contribution between the two free energy states of the molecular motor, if they are different. This is the free energy change of the solution. So mu is the chemical potential of alpha is ATP, ADP, A of phosphate. This is how many numbers of ATP, ADP, or phosphate are involved in the transition. And this is the free energy change of the weight, because if the weight is pulled one unit, its free energy raises, right? Now we are at an engine. Molecular is driven by chemicals, and it pulls a weight. It's not a heat engine, because it's all at constant temperature. It's what we call an isothermal engine, which transforms chemical energy into mechanical motion. But the same rule. Look here, Rob.
Yes.
It's still the same equation.
Yep.
And you better use this. If you use anything else, you violate the second law. Yes?
So these assumptions would change if, let's say, the concentration of ATP was so high that you can't define mesostates.
Well, you see, what are the mesostates now? Good question. So the mesostate is now the state of the motor. Let's say if a T binds, this is another mesostate. If the T becomes a D plus a PI, but still at the motor, another mesostate. The PI leaves, another mesostate. So you still only focus on the motor. You put a little box on it. And, you know, if two ATPs at the same time could bind, fine. Then we just have a higher number of mesostates. But in principle, you can do this even for a denser solution of ATPs. What will change then is that the relation between the concentration and the free energy, the chemical potential, is not longer mu is kT ln C.
Well, I guess
you would have activity.
So what if the motor is moving very fast between these mesostates?
That's fine. It still will be slower than the water. It still will be slower than the ATP moving around. You only need the times, you know, time scale. You still need time scale separation, but it can be fast. So, if you now assume that you keep the concentrations or the chemical potentials of that stuff fixed and the fixed force, the motor runs into what is called a non-equilibrium steady state. It's not time-dependent driving like in the unfolding. We have constant external conditions, but these are non-equilibrium steady-state conditions. And from now on, I think I will exclusively talk about non-equilibrium steady-states for the rest of the talk.
Excuse me.
Yes?
Just to make sure. So this is having a constant source of ATP come in.
Being in the solution, yes. Coming into the motor, yes.
So is it still a closed system or an open system? It seems that
it's an open system.
Because the ATP is coming in source and then ADP is going out.
Well, the ADP, you know, binds to the motor and then it's released in the solution. So from the perspective of the motor, it's an open system. You see you could imagine the motor having a little box which I didn't draw around it.
So
a little dashed box. And then the red stuff comes in and the yellow stuff gets out.
Yeah, so maybe another way of asking what I'm trying to understand is that if the ATP runs out...
Oh, then it's a different story. Then we're back at equilibrium.
That is what I was trying to see. Is it like a battery?
Yeah, you have to provide... So, you know, conceptually, you have to assume that you refill the ATP.
Okay, okay. So it is like a battery, in other words. You're taking the chemical energy.
Yes. But you see, even when you do the experiment, you may not be able to refill the ATP, but for a while, the ATP concentration will not change if you have one motor there, or only a few. Okay, two questions, yes?
Can I ask a dumb question? In what sense is this not equilibrium? You know, detailed balance, there's free energy.
Okay, good question. So I call that local detailed balance. This local is the key word. There are fluxes, as we will see. You have to distinguish global detailed balance, where you have no currents, no fluxes, from... You see, in this situation, you constantly turn ATP into ADP with a constant rate. This word is referring to the fact that the ratio of these rates is still governed by these thermodynamic quantities. But it's definitely a non-equilibrium system.
So I also find that a little bit confusing. So what is balanced in this case? So
well, the rates are balanced. The ratio is in a certain way balanced. It's not one-to-one balanced, but it's balanced with this ratio. You know, it may not be the most perfect name for this, but it has its... Right, Jordan? It's used like this.
I mean, the way I usually think about it is if you take that IJ reaction out of the network and it was all by itself, then equilibrium detailed balance would demand that ratio is equal to an exponential. And now you say, well, if I put that reaction now into the network, you can't change that rule anymore. And that's kind of where the name comes from, but it's definitely not an equilibrium required.
Okay. Now I need two slides and on another type of system where the states are not discrete but continuous. So my favorite example is a colloidal particle which is driven across this periodic potential via force. And you can do all this with laser technology these days. I will be brief here, but essentially the message is you can do exactly the same thing if you don't have a master equation, but you do have what is called the Langevin dynamics. So the instantaneous velocity is given by the gradient of the potential, this non-conservative force driving it, and some noise, and the noise is delta correlated. And then, this is genuine Sekimoto, you can actually cast this Langevin dynamics in the form of a first law. These are the identifications. We don't have to do it in detail, but I want to introduce a second definition of total entropy change, which is important. Suppose I show you a trajectory of this experiment. And then I show you the same trajectory, the movie which played backwards. Will you be able to tell me which one is the correct movie? Which one is the correct experiment, and where did I show you the trajectory backwards?
You're showing us the meso movies?
I show you, X here is meso. Okay. So, you know, the particle should go this way, right? And if I show you the movie the other way, it goes like this, and then you tell me, no, this is not, this cannot happen. I mean, in principle, it can happen, but the probability is very low. And let's make this quantitative. You can compare the probability of having a trajectory, and you can look at the probability of having a time-reverse trajectory, capital tau here is the total runtime, so you just reverse x, i.e. you reverse velocities. And then another definition, which is totally consistent and in a sense the same as before, but just in different words, the total entropy change along a trajectory is the log ratio for the probability of seeing this trajectory compared to the probability of seeing the time-reversed one. And when you work out the algebra, you find it's precisely what we had before. But it's a nice way of introducing entropy change along a trajectory. It's a measure for breaking time reversal symmetry. this sense.
So we time reverse the experiment with protocol 2 here.
If there was a time-dependent control parameter, but in this case we don't have, because we're in an S. There is a constant force, and we don't reverse the force.
So, I think this may be a very silly question, but so from that last line, how do I distinguish between the two trajectories?
Well, you see, for each trajectory you have a weight, which I didn't write down here, path integral weight.
So I see ensembles of these trajectories.
In order to have the P defined, you first have to have the ensemble. But once you state the Langevin equation, you get this contains implicitly a prescription for the probability P of X of seeing a whole trajectory.
Right.
I don't write that down, but okay. And now you can take this formal expression and you plug in the time reverse trajectory. And then you get a probability which is perhaps only 1/100th of the original one. And then this will tell you that the entropy change along the original one is ln 100. That's how it works. Okay, for later, in this case, we will need it a couple of times later. Let's introduce affinity. Affinity is essentially the force times the distance of one revolution. So this is essentially the thermodynamic force driving the system. Let me show you experimental data for this very system. First, we have to, because you asked for it, Dan, you asked me to tell you about the fluctuation theorem and how useful it is for experiments. So first tell you about the fluctuation theorem. It's here. In this non-equilibrium steady state, there is a distribution, right? I told you about distributions of such thermodynamic quantities. And Evans et al., that started, in a sense, the field, found numerically for sheared fluids that the probability distribution obeys this remarkable symmetry. So basically what that means is if I tell you the probability to observe positive entropy production, the whole positive axis, this equation tells you the probability of seeing a negative entropy production. Again, we have here negative entropy production, which is against second law of classical thermodynamics. Okay, and that was later proven under various circumstances. Let me show you data. So this is an experiment we did 10 years ago with my experimental colleague in Stuttgart, exactly the system. We measured entropy production, and here you see the red distribution is, after 2 seconds, you have this kind of entropy production in the system. After 20 seconds, you have the black one. These are non-Gaussian distributions, highly non-trivial. Still, if you plot them in this fashion, take the logarithm, then the right-hand side becomes a slope 1. These are the experimental data. The slope should be 1. This is experimental slope after a certain time, and you see it fluctuates around 1. So Dan said I should tell you what the fluctuation theorem is good for. It's a nice theoretical conceptual result. It becomes helpful if you see it violated. If you find in your experiment that it holds true, it doesn't tell you a terrible lot about your system because it's a theorem. What it tells you is that your experimental system complies with the assumptions which went into deriving the theorem. What were these assumptions? The assumptions were Markovian dynamics, constant driving, and this kind of identification of entropy production. But you will learn something if it's violated, and that will be my next example. Yes?
Weren't the fluctuation theorem shown in a much more general setting where you're even beyond a non-equilibrium steady state, and the only assumption was like the axiom of causality, which seems pretty...
Well, there are versions of it. Perhaps you're referring to Krug theorem, or there are various versions of it, but the original one was for a non-equilibrium steady state situation.
Okay. Yeah, I think later on they proved this in the 90s and early 2000s that they went beyond the non-equilibrium steady state, beyond Markov.
As I said, I mean, yeah. You know, there's a whole zoo, but I'm trying to keep things simple. And historically, this was important for this non-equilibrium steady state situation. Yes?
And then the first two examples, you sort of walked us through, I had an easy time mapping them onto biology because you showed us RNA structure.
Yeah.
I'm having a harder time with this. So what? The colloidal. Fantastic.
Of course. Of course. Okay. Now let me talk about this. This was a try to apply this to the F1 ATPase. So I guess you all know the ATPase is this rotary thing. You can take off the F1 part, you put it on a cover slip, you provide it with an excess of ADP, and then this purple subunit turns around 120 degrees with each hydrolysis step. You wouldn't see that. You can see it only if you put a big micro-sized object to it, which is called a probe particle. And when the purple thing turns around, this big thing, like a hand of a watch, is turning around. And then you can measure the angle as a function of time, and you get traces like this. Blue is you provide only a little bit of ATP excess, and then you can see 120 degree steps. Red is you provide a lot of fuel, and then it's running fast, and you're no longer able to resolve individual steps very well. Okay, but these kind of data you get, since the late 90s, Kinoshita was the first to do that. Now you can plot the distribution of these angles after a certain time, and you get this kind of Gaussian-like shapes. And now you do a simple theory. You say, okay, this is just rotary Brownian motion. This is the angle, this is the friction, this is the torque, and this is some noise. If you buy this equation, you get in two lines this kind of symmetry of the distribution of having a certain angle after certain. You see, this is independent of time. This would hold for any time. And from the slope, you could infer the torque, which would be nice. That was their original idea. But there was a problem. The problem was when you plotted this torque or the slope, you get something which is time dependent. And if you buy just this, and I should say this is equivalent of stating the fluctuation theorem for this simple dynamics, then this should be time independent. So now you know it does not obey the fluctuation theorem. There's something going on. What is going on? Well, the reason is that in this system you have two slow degrees of freedom. What you see is the position of this probe particle. But you also have the motor. And you see sometimes the motor may advance, but there is some loose coupling between these two. And then the probe particle doesn't yet come along. So when you model it, you have to keep at least 2 degrees of freedom. That's what we did here. So, you know, it's simpler to map this rotary motion to a linear motion. So the motor, the purple thing is this. This corresponds to 120 degree steps. It's driven by the chemistry to the right, but there's this micron-sized probe particle, and I connect them with a harmonic potential, with a tether. Now you see, what happens when the motor moves 120 degrees, it's loading that tether, and then this big sphere will come along. So you have 2 degrees of freedom, which are relevant, but you see only one. And one of the assumptions of the fluctuation theorem is that you see all slow degrees of freedom. And if you don't, you cannot expect the fluctuation theorem to hold. So if you now simulate this, you get curves which very much look like the experimental ones. If you look at this pseudo-slope here as a function of time, you get precisely what is found in the experiment. With the same model, we can also look at the energetics. This is essentially what I told you before. Again, for the first law. So you have to think about these two ingredients. So suppose the probe particle moves a distance delta x, and we are applying an external torque here, like in the experiment. Well, if that probe particle moves, what does the first law tell you? Then the external force puts in work, and this work either it becomes heat, or it loads the spring. If the motor moves, what is work? There is no work, but there is heat. The potential energy of the spring changes, and because there's a chemical reaction, here it's ATP, here it's ADP plus PI, the internal energy of the solution does change, and this is important. So this is on the individual motion trajectory level. Now you look at the mean, then this here cancels. and you plug in the relation between the energy and the free energy and the entropy of the solution, and then you find that the chemical energy you put in minus the external work is the dissipation, which is the dissipation due to the motion of the probe particle, dissipation due to the heat, due to the chemical reactions, and then there's an entropy change in the solution. And there's no way how you could distinguish between those two. Okay, so this is the kind of theoretical analysis. Here is the experiment. So they had to measure the heat.
Question. Yeah? So the two or three slides ago, you showed how if the machine is slow, then you can observe it in three angles.
Yeah.
But if it's fast, it seems to be this circle, basically.
Yeah, but this is temporal resolution of your experiment.
So the circle is not really real, it's because the particle cannot move fast enough to follow the order.
No,
the
instrumentation doesn't follow.
The instrumentation.
Rob.
Yeah, and that's not even fast. So I guess I was kind of curious. What are your thoughts? It really runs at 100 hertz. This is running at 1 hertz. You know. So
You mean
the real engine in real life runs at 100 hertz?
Okay.
I'm just curious. I understand perfectly what you said about the experiment, but I'm not asking about the experiment. I'm more curious about, you know, is there anything when it's running at these normal speeds that is going to make this more subtle, or?
I wouldn't expect so. No. Okay. You see, there is no time scale in this kind of theory. And that's actually, in a sense, also a problem, because if you want to find bounds on time scales, it will be hard with this kind of theory. We'll come to that. So they wanted to measure the efficiency.
The basic question, is there a metric that tells us how badly we are missing degrees of freedom?
Oh, that's a good question. I think no general one. No general one. I mean, you know, if that slope differs much from one. But we looked into certain models and we found that even if you miss, it still often looks almost like one. But this is very non-universal. I can't make general statements. Okay, let me just be brief here. So they didn't measure the heat calorimetrically. But they used what is called another of these exact relations. The experts will see here the violation of the equilibrium FDT. They measured this frequency dependent. They got this kind of diagram where you compare the work and the heat to the delta mu of the ATP hydrolysis. We do the same here within the model, and you know, given experimental error bars, there is decent agreement even when we use this kind of simple model. So, and on the basis of this, they concluded that this motor is quite efficient. But of course, you know, there's no fundamental limit to the efficiency. The efficiency has to be smaller than one. But, you know, even if it's 40 or 60% efficient in transforming free energy into mechanical motion, you know, that's certainly okay. And you should not expect that it's much less efficient. I'll show you, in a sense, more interesting data when we, in the next part, when we do the uncertainty relation. So my point here is, in order to do this comparison, you have to do a theoretical model, right? We have to do this model with rates, and we make it thermodynamically consistent, but there are still parameters. And at the end of the day, yes, you can reproduce this, but there's not a terrible lot you learn from this kind of comparison. So in the next step, I want to show you something which is much more spectacular and where you can infer efficiency, bounds on efficiency, which are model independent, totally model independent. Yes?
So I think I missed it. What is the Q that is gray versus the Q that is blue?
Okay, these are different contributions to the heat. One is the steady state contribution. The other one is this violation of the FDT. I know that I should spend more time talking about this, but I guess I would lose half of the audience or need the rest of my time. And there's something more exciting, which is more recent. Okay, so here comes the thermodynamic uncertainty relation. Now you can relax, and I'll try to explain it in simple ways. As an example, it will be a relation between the cost of precision, I mean, between precision and the cost of having a process which is precise. So for a process, in the simplest case, I imagine something which moves to the right. You know, it could be a molecular motor. It could be an enzyme producing something else in each step. And the only rule is that it moves to the right with a certain rate k plus, and it goes back with a certain rate k minus. And on average, after time t, you have the molecule or the process has made that many steps. Now, what we want with precision is we want this process to be precise in the sense that after fixed time, we always make the same number of steps. So after 10 seconds, we always want 10 steps. Then we call it precise or certain. Now, in a finite environment, this is impossible. Sometimes it will make 11, sometimes it will make 9. So let's characterize this variance. Well, you do the simple algebra, you find that this variance, of course, is linear in time. It's given by the sum of the rates, and this is called the diffusion coefficient. The uncertainty squared is defined as the variance divided by the output squared. And so that will decrease in time. The longer you wait, in a sense, the smaller this uncertainty is. That's okay. That's just a general feature of diffusive processes. The new aspect is about the thermodynamic cost. You see, if that process moves preferentially to the right, someone has to pay for it. In equilibrium, it wouldn't do that. So you can ask, how much do you have to pay for it to move to the right? And that's the thermodynamic cost. And using the rules which I gave you earlier, it's given by this expression in terms of the two rates. And sigma is the entropy production. This is just what you lose, the entropy production times the time. So you see the uncertainty goes like 1 over time, this goes like time. If you multiply the two, you find this relation. So the cost times the uncertainty squared, which is 2 times the entropy production times the diffusion coefficient, that's the variance, divided by the mean current squared. This, if you work it out, it's larger than 2kBT in this particular example, independent of runtime. So what does it mean? It means if you want to have small epsilon, high precision, you have to pay a lot. Precision does not come for free. There is a in this example, there is a bound on the precision which you can reach with a certain cost. It's what you could call the inevitable universal cost of precision. Because it turns out, and this is something we found, this was my postdoc, Andre Barato. We did the simple model, we did lots of numerics, we did limiting cases, we found that, we conjectured it. And then Todd Gingrich and Jordan Horowitz and Grant proved it. And this is a really hard proof. I can say this because we tried for half a year, and I guess you guys also tried for half a year. This is highly non-trivial. This is much harder than proving Yerzhinsky or the fluctuation theorem. I'm not going to show the proof. The key point is that what we found in this simple example and in numerics of more complicated examples will hold for any process which is based on a stationary Markov network. So I try to sketch here something more complicated. So this is a motor moving against a force which with 4 internal states. You can have any number of internal states. You can have any wiring. You can have any driving as long as it's steady state conditions. ATP or ATP and GDP, and you can use 3 ATPs for a step or 1, doesn't matter. You can't beat that. That's why it's so
so if you have something like integral feedback, I'm just trying to think back to the question about biology. If there's history, in the sense that the system actually cares what happened over the last 2 minutes or 1 minute or whatever, does that violate the Markovian?
Well, if you can formulate this feedback in, with enough states as a non-equilibrium steady state situation, and I think you can, then it will hold.
No, I get that. I'm curious whether you can. But
yeah.
That's interesting.
Okay, so now I want to show you, okay.
I'm having a little trouble understanding what you mean by precision, because.
Yeah, okay, by precision, I mean, do you understand that on average after time t, it makes n steps? And I can look at the variance of that. Precision is the variance divided by the mean squared. If the variance is zero, the precision is infinite, i.e. the uncertainty is zero. Precision is the inverse uncertainty. OK, now I'll show you an example which hopefully convinces you that this is a really useful universal tool.
So, basic question.
Yeah.
There's no metric of the speed at which the process is.
No, there's no time scale involved. You see, that's what I said here. The epsilon squared goes generically like 1 over t. The cost goes, you know, the longer you run, product is time independent. And you see, this is why it's useful, because, you know, this is dimensionless. I mean, if you measure energy in terms of kVt, it's dimensionless. Yeah?
So if a cell, for example, receives a signal, and then it makes a message, like an RNA molecule, it's always going to make 1,000 molecules of that RNA per concentration of the message it receives. You say this costs energy if the variance of the RNA molecule is very low.
Yes. So it does.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In your estimate of the thermodynamic cost of the particle, there is a sigma there, right?
Yes.
And that sigma is what?
That is the mean entropy production rate, which I can write in terms of these probabilities and rates. It's not an estimate. So this is what it is. It's not an estimate. It's not an approximation.
So just trying to understand physically. So you need to reduce the cost.
Yeah.
That is, you need to reduce the entropy production.
Yes.
And that is why you call it the
cost. Yes. Because entropy production is wasted free energy.
Right, and this is only, so this particular cost is only related to the forward versus backward, not the other configurational aspects that are going.
Well, you see, in a more complicated, here you don't have internal degrees of freedom. In a more complicated setup, you have what I guess you call other aspects, and if there is entropy production involved in these cycles, then yes, this will be included. You'll see it in a moment.
Okay, so in other words, just a second more, this is actually the cost of the reversibility, in a way.
Yes, this is
other aspects you're not considering, it seems.
Well, I don't know what other aspects you're referring
to. There could be internal degrees of freedom.
No, they are included. They are included. If the internal degrees of freedom dissipate, they are included. And if they don't dissipate, there is no cost. You know, if you load an internal spring and you get the energy back, this is not dissipation.
Okay.
But you can come up with any wiring of your system, and this will be true.
I see.
Let me show you an example, which hopefully convinces you. So, because you can now use it for what you could call thermodynamic inference. So again, we do molecular motor. This time, it's kinesin running on a microtubule against an externally imposed constant force implemented by this laser trap on a test bit. These are 20-year-old data from Steve Bloch's lab. What did they measure? They measured the velocity of this motor. They measured the variance, the diffusion coefficient, and they plotted it in this particular fashion. They did not measure the ATP, because they don't see how many ATP mod, okay? And if you look at what is called the randomness as a function of ATP for various applied forces, you get this data. If you look at the load as a function of the load for constant ATP, you get this data. So the data have been around for 20 years. And now we're using this relation to get something interesting. So let me, in this particular case, what is the entropy production rate? So that's what you put in minus what you get out. What you put in, you don't know, because you don't see the ATP molecules. And you don't know how many it needs for one step. Or you do not need to know. What you get out is motion against the force. That's just lifting the weight. What is efficiency? Efficiency is what you get out divided by what you get in, what you put in. What you get out is mechanical power. What you put in, we just said we don't know. But we do know that what you put in is what you get out plus what is wasted. And for what is wasted, we have this inequality. So we put that in and we're here. The right-hand side, so the efficiency is less than the right-hand side. The right-hand side are only measurable quantities, the velocity, the diffusion, the force, and kBT. Now I take this data and I just plot this curve. And you get this kind of diagram. So this is precisely the diagram I showed you before. The colored curves is this theory. So let's take this dot here. At this dot, there was a load of about 2 piconewton, and there is a randomness, i.e. a ratio between velocity and diffusion of about 0.4. Our theory tells you that at this point, this motor is at most 45% efficient in transforming chemical energy into mechanical work. Maybe less, maybe only 4%, but definitely not more than 45%. And I think that's a spectacular statement, because we didn't put in anything about how the motor works. We did not put in the mechanochemical cycles. We did not even put in the chemical potential of the ATP hydrolysis. We didn't need that.
But how do you know it's right?
It's a theorem.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, fine, but there's experiments, and it's not like you're drawing a curve and saying, I predicted this particular functional form, yeah, and then I observed this functional
form. Rob, I'm sure that if you could count the ATP molecules.
Which you can now.
Okay, now then this is no longer unknown. And I promise you, if you do the experiment, you will find it's less than 45% here. Perhaps it's only a tenth, I don't know, of 45%. But it's definitely not more. And you see here, for instance, it's less than 85 or 80, and here it's less than 15%. And my claim is this is the first time that you can make a statement on the efficiency of molecular motor which is model-free. What I showed you before, the Toyabe data, this was based on our model. And here we do not get an equality. We get an upper bound, but you know sometimes it's nice to have at least an upper bound. Yes, please, Simone.
So can you make an independent estimate by saying, say you consume one ATP molecule per step, the length of the step, and so on?
Now you're back at the specific model. And then we did that. I don't have it here, or I will not find it fast. We did that for the simple model I introduced earlier. And then you can measure the true efficiency, and you can overlay this curve, and you see they are at most 20 or 30% off.
Okay.
But you know, there's no guarantee that the true motor will be close to the bound. Could be much less, but it's definitely not more. Yes, please.
So could you use this to exclude possible microscopic models? Based on if they sort of give you the wrong efficiency?
Yes. Of course, you know, if you use a thermodynamically consistent microscopic model with thermodynamically consistent rates, you can't beat it.
But let's say I start with some experimental data, and then I put together a naive theory.
Yeah.
Then it could be possible to say, oh, yeah, this can't,
yeah,
I see.
Yeah. You see, this, I mean, you know, this, I just took the published data, and I think this is just the beginning, because this is now what everybody should do with his or her data. Yes, please.
For example, that question actually, so people have proposed efficiencies for like this F1 ATPase that you just talked about. Can you actually, is there enough data for you to test, for example, your prediction there, where actually efficiency is predicted to be pretty high or so?
We see here that it can be high.
Yes.
Who was that? I think a Korean group they did more sophisticated models of the F1 ATPase, and they use this kind of relation.
Right. I think that could possibly be where there's enough data to actually maybe even reject that microscopic model if like it's inconsistent or like.
Well, as I said, I mean, you know, if your microscopic model is thermodynamically consistent, you will not be able to reject it. So I'd rather have real experimental data, and you know, you plug it in. Every experimentalist can do that. You just plug it in here, and you see what you get. So,
Can you mean so, like, if let's say, like, experimentally, you did the same experiment, you know, with this 2 millimolar ATP, and then started adding ADP and PI.
So then
eventually, if you add enough, then that's an equilibrium.
Yes.
So then you kind of like have to kind of like start hitting the bound at one point.
Or you may. I mean, that's the question: is which process saturates the bound?
Okay. Yeah.
So we know that close to equilibrium, and if you're current which you measure, i.e. here the velocity, is proportional to the entropy production, then close to equilibrium you saturate the bound. Typically deep in the non-equilibrium regime you cannot saturate, at least not a simple bound with the 2. Here is a 2. I mean, there are no more sophisticated versions where you have additional information about the driving affinity. And then you get another function here. So there are now better bounds. But this better bound needs more input about the topology of your network, about the driving forces. This is the simple one here is the most fundamental one, is completely independent. If you know more, you can get stronger statements. Yes? Jonathan?
Could you define what you mean by close to equilibrium and far, very far?
Okay. Close to equilibrium, okay, so here we have ATP hydrolysis. The delta mu of the ATP is 20 kBT. You have e to the 20, this is far from 1. So if delta mu is small compared to kBT, which it actually never is, but then you would be, theoretically speaking, close to equilibrium.
On the next slide, on your I'm trying to see where the velocity, V is the velocity.
Yeah, V is the velocity.
And what is the unit for that?
Meter per second.
Okay, and you have an entropy production rate.
Yeah, that's 1/2 second, because for me entropy is dimensionless.
Okay.
Just another comment about the tightness of the bound. It depends to some extent on what you can measure also. Like in these examples, this is a one-dimensional velocity, right, that you're looking along. But if you imagine you have two dimensions and you're only measuring in one, there could be another dimension along which you're moving very fast and dissipating a lot of energy. But if you're not seeing that, you know, your inference will be quite bad, because the entropy production that goes into this is the total entropy production. It includes that entropy production in the direction that you're not measuring.
Yeah.
So in some sense, you need to be measuring, you know, the right currents in order for the inference to be good.
And then it's like hypothetically, if you had something like, you know, let's say you're on the one hand both doing some microscopy and you see stuff and that, but of course then you don't know whether you're seeing all the you're not seeing all the relevant ones or whatever. But then you also have, let's say, like a calorimetric information. So I mean, that's kind of a global. Could you somehow like combine those two now to start saying like, have you seen all the relevant, or is that not?
I mean, in principle, if you can actually measure like, you know, the total dissipation in the system, then you could build, you know, a hierarchy of models that should get you closer and closer to something that gets, you know, close to saturating the bound, but. I mean, in general, you know, my impression is that getting good data on the total entropy production of the system is the hard part.
Yes. Yes.
It's much easier to measure some combination of currents.
But if you literally have a thing on the calorimeter, doesn't that tell you?
That would help.
Yeah.
That would help.
Yeah.
That would help.
There aren't that many people who can do that at the single molecule level.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Not yet. Yeah, so, okay, so yeah, you need it, because if you just have the ensemble, that doesn't tell you.
Better than nothing, but. It would be nicer to have it on the single one.
Yeah, okay, fine. That's possible,
I guess. Okay.
Sorry, yeah. Be possible. And yeah. Your F is now what again?
The force.
The force.
You see, it runs against imposed force. So the force is, this is this laser trap. It's pulling to the left and it's running to the right. Okay.
So your unit of chemical energy has a temperature in it somewhere?
That's delta mu, yes. And it's all energy
one,
units
one
are in KBT.
Right?
In KBT, yeah, yeah.
If you made the entropy dimensionless, your energy is probably 1/T.
Exactly, exactly.
And this velocity is the velocity of the forward motion?
This is the mean velocity. So it's a mean net velocity.
So have you subtracted out?
Yes. In the mean, I have subtracted the backward steps.
Okay, so you have subtracted out the random, and it is an average.
It's an average
drift velocity.
Exactly, an average drift velocity. Yeah. You see, you don't need to see. You don't even need to see individual steps for this analysis. Okay, so let me. What is when I'm supposed to stop?
I guess we're supposed to start in 5 minutes, but it's like up to us.
Okay.
As far as I know.
So give me 10.
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Sure. I want to come to my last point because I think this is something people have started talking about too, and this is now in a sense more detailed about a slightly different aspect, which is temporal precision. In an aqueous finite temperature environment, I mean, it's the same question, right? You have this watch. You want that in one day it makes 86,400 second steps. Sometimes it does more, sometimes it does less. It has to run at a finite temperature. And what we're looking at is the phase coherence of oscillations. There are many systems in biology, and you know, almost everybody here, all biologists know more about it than I do. So this is one circadian clock system which was reconstructed from a certain bacterium, and it oscillates as a function of the here it's as a function of the ADP. Now the key point is not that it oscillates. The key point is that it oscillates in phase, that it always takes the same time from one maximum to the other. That's what you want with a clock, right? You do not want that it runs around, you want that it runs around in a precise fashion.
Can I just contradict you a little and say that 24-hour time scale of molecule clock is in itself interesting? Like you're saying,
yes.
The phase is interesting, but so is the absolute time.
Yes, the absolute thing, but you're right, but there are simple models for the absolute thing,
like
oscillator.
It's crazy.
And we wanted to understand, you see, again, the hypothesis is the more coherent it is, the more you have to pay for it. And, you know, our style is, again, with Andre, looking at simple systems. So this is a simple clock, it's n states. And what is plotted here is the probability to be in state 1 if you have been in state 1 at time t if you have been in state 1 at time 0. And that decays, even though the whole thing is running around all the time, but it loses this phase coherence. So here, for instance, these are data. You take 100 sites, not just 3, 100 states, and you drive it, that's the driving affinity, that's the number of states times this log ratio of forward-backward reaction rates for one step. So here by naked eye you see after about 4 oscillations, the amplitude is down a factor of 1 over E. So this is what I call calligraphic N, 4 coherent oscillations. Then you have lost your phase coherence. I mean, it's still oscillating, but you've lost to be in registry with your first time. So you can express this as a correlation function. This is what I just said. You want to be in state 1 at time t, being there at time 0. And quite generally, such a correlation function becomes a superposition of exponentials. And these exponentials can be complex or have to be complex when you oscillate. So in this simple model, you can work out this capital N, or calligraphic N. It's basically the imaginary part of the second eigenvalue divided by the real part. You plug in the numbers. You find that it's smaller than the driving affinity. So the more you drive, the more covariant oscillations you get. And the more states you have, the more you can get. Again, this is a simple model. Our conjecture is that this relation is universal. We have no proof for that yet. As far as I know, Jordan and Grant don't have a proof yet.
No, we tried.
Yeah, we tried too. But that's even harder than the other one. That's harder than the other one. But we did a lot of numerics. Let me jump over this. We did a lot of numerics, so we're convinced that it's true. And again, so again, true in the sense we discussed before. You can have any wiring. You look at oscillations, and the number of coherent oscillations is less than this expression. Now you have to go over all cycles. And you have to understand, if you have many states, you can draw many closed loops. So you have many cycles. And the best cycle, this could be the best cycle, will be bounded by this relation. Okay, and on the last two slides, I want to show you just one example, which we did. This is the model introduced by Yuhai and his co-workers in this Nature Physics paper. So it's an enzyme which can be in four different conformations, phosphorylated, dephosphorylated. There is here the kinase, there is the phosphatase, which is called here the activator. R is the activator because R promotes its own production. It also promotes the production of an inhibitor. X inhibits R, so here is a kind of feedback loop. And when you do this, what I just explained, you take these equations, you run them, and you look at the, for instance, number of MPs or Ms or Xs, you get these oscillations. You get oscillations. Again, the question is about phase coherence. And this is now an enormous, this is my last technical slide, this is an enormous state space, because you have roughly about 100 molecules of each species. So let's say you have two conservation laws, so this would be five independent ones, so you have 100 to the five states. Because each, you know, a tuple of M, MR, MP, K molecules is a state. And if you have one more MP and one less MK, it's another state. It's an enormous state space. And in this enormous state space, you would have to find the cycle which has this largest value, which is very, very hard. But, so you get roughly about, so this R is 2 pi scaled version of the N, sorry for that, you get something which is of the order of 1,000. These are numerical data based on simulating this master equation. If you assume that they go through the cycle coherently, you come up with an estimate where this is the number of kinase times the delta mu for the cycle divided by 4 pi squared. These are these colored lines, and they are about a factor 2 of the simulation data. So what is the baseline? The baseline is we have here what we believe, again, a universal upper bound for the cost of creating coherent oscillations. This is harder to apply than the previous one on the uncertainty relation, but it's of a similar type. And we looked at this here. This was just one case study. I think one should now look at more cases to get a better understanding of this, but this is roughly where we are in understanding universal cost of creating coherent oscillations. Okay. As I said, all of this was about non-equilibrium steady state. Let me just tell you about two results, which are now for the next logical class of systems, which are periodically driven states. So suppose you have something which is under external periodic signal, where you have some driving period, tau or some frequency, or capital omega.
Good question. What was the rationale using the number of kinases rather than the number of phosphatases?
They compete for the kinases. So you see the kinases are coming in, you know, 30, 40. So the model is such that the number of the kinases is the kind of bottleneck.
Okay, because of alpha density.
They have to compete for that if they want to go through that cycle in a coherent fashion. There could be other circumstances where you could do the other. Okay. Just two results. You remember this thermodynamic uncertainty relation, which if you have this was for non-equilibrium steady states. Now we assume that the system is driven periodically, externally. Some external signal is periodically going up and down. Then the entropy production, the diffusion coefficient, the mean current, i.e. the velocity, they will all depend on this frequency. So what my grad student has recently proven is that the right-hand side of the uncertainty relation, which used to be 2, or if you use these quantities, it's 1, gets modified by an expression which is very transparent. J is the current or the velocity of your process, and J prime is how that current depends if you change omega. This is the derivative of the current with respect to the driving frequency. And you see, for instance, if that dependence is linear, then this thing is 1, and then the right-hand side is 0. So in periodically driven systems, you have the option of dissipation-less precision. And this is something we found earlier in a case study, and now we understand it. So the earlier result was, and that's why I was emphasizing it all the time, was under non-equilibrium steady-state conditions. If you periodically drive, let's say you take your hand off your watch, and in a sense, you move it periodically around. This is what we did, what we call the Brownian clock. And there we found that you could get dissipation-less precision. And now we understand that this is when this factor here becomes 1. So 1 minus 1 is 0, 0 squared is 0. So just as a message, if you have a periodically driven system and you can measure currents and dispersion as a function of the driving frequency, at least in a certain range, you get again from this an estimate on your entropy production, which is kind of nice. I don't have experimental examples yet. And the second thing is, we also looked at coherent oscillations when you have periodic driving, and here we found that the number of states does not pose a fundamental limit. So you could have infinitely coherent oscillations, even in a finite end system, which you would not be able to have under steady state conditions. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to tell you. I don't need a summary, but I want to emphasize that the molecular motor work was with my grad student Patrick Pitsonka, who is now a postdoc with my case in Cambridge, and Eva Zimmermann, who went to industry. And this more recent stuff was in a very nice collaboration, starting when Andre was with me, and now he's faculty at the University of Houston, and Patrick also did his PhD on that. Thank you very much.
Back here at 1:30.
Yeah.
Determines the best system?
Well, best in terms of having, you know, the largest quantity here. A is the driving affinity in the cycle, which is the log ratio of all forward rates divided by backward rates. N is the number of states. And you have, you know, N is smaller than this, so the best cycle in the sense for which this ratio is the biggest.
But there's no prescription that you can just look at the circuit and say, okay, this should be best.
Well, you see, for 2 or 3 cycles, yes. But in this other case, we have billions of cycles.
Thank you.